Chelsea and Frank Lampard have been reunited after the legendary midfielder finally agreed to become head coach yesterday. Someone who knows all about playing and managing the Blues is former Chelsea captain and manager John Hollins. Morning, John.
Good morning. Beautiful morning.
Isn't it just? It's going to be a beautiful day, I believe, as well. Just how good a deal is this for Frank Lampard? It does feel that like the right fit at this point in time, doesn't it?
It does. It certainly does. It's a situation where he's coming in, everybody is more or less familiar with him, know what he's like, know what he's capable of. But he's not going to play. He's going to be the manager and organise games to win and really sort of, it will be exciting.
Mm.
Unfortunately, the thing is, the players that are there are the only ones he can play with. He's got his youth set up as well. So we might see a lot of young players getting chances. And I think, you know, could sort of really be it'd be enjoyable because everybody will look up to Frank and say, well, he's done it, he's been there, he's won trophies, and he's a good guy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, look, you played 592 games, Chelsea, scoring 69 goals. It's like puts you, I think, fifth, isn't it, on the all-time most appearances for Chelsea. Frank Lampard is fourth. And a bit like Frank Lampard, you also made the transition of going from a Chelsea player into being Chelsea manager. How did you find that? Have you got any words of advice for Frank Lampard about maybe how he should go about it at his old club?
Well, it is difficult because what you can say is that you've played with most of these players, watched them play as well, the youth set up as well. And I just think that it's someone might say, hi Frank, I mean, boss,
yeah. You know, sort of,
those sort of things. But, you know, Frank is a guy that he understands the players. He understands the way it's going to be played. Mm. And being in the middle of the pitch, which is midfield and looking backwards and forwards, I think he's ideal for that. He can be people that would move forward quicker. And I think we had a little problem last year of so who was going to play in midfield and which one would be the one that would go forward. I think that would be interesting. I think that would be exciting.
Yeah, well, indeed. You touched on the fact they're going to play younger players. Is that something you're excited about seeing? Because I know Jody Morris has described the youth system there as the best in the world, I believe he's described it as, certainly the best in England. And, of course, their performances in the Youth Cup over the last few years have proven that as well. So surely there must be so much talent sat there in the under-23s and in the academy.
Well, this is the chance. This is the time because you can't buy any players. You can't move any players either to the club. I think in a year. So what he's got in front of him is what he will be dealing with. And as you say, his youth setup is excellent. Unfortunately, I think the young boy that got injured in America.
Yes, Callum Hudson-Odoi.
I like him. But I don't know how long he's going to be. That one could be a player that's saying, really coming into the side would be a breath of fresh air. But I don't know how long he's going to be injured. And a couple of the other boys that have also been injured that have been there and have only played maybe one or two, three, four games. This would be, it's an exciting, look at it, supporters, look at it as an important and exciting time because the players say, well, I've only seen him once, twice.
Mm.
This guy will come in and, it'll be interesting. Unfortunately, Mr. Hazard has gone. He served us extremely well. I think he's been a real honour to be in our side because he's saved all the games for, you know, really, you know, wanted to be a supporter's man, and he certainly did that.
Mm. Indeed. Great stuff. John, real pleasure having you on. Thank you very much.
You take care.
Great stuff. That's John Hollins there, former Chelsea manager and captain as well. And fifth-time all-record appearance maker.
Yeah, exactly. He's kind of followed in Frank Lampard's footsteps pretty much. So so Frank Lampard has got just a handful more caps than John. So and obviously John Dane did kind of wander straight into taking that Chelsea job. Frank Lampard obviously had a year out at Derby, but I think he's going to be almost a match made in heaven here with Chelsea. Frank Lampard, nobody knows the inner workings of that club more than him. And it's so much better for him coming back now than in 5 years' time, because by which time the youth setup might have changed. A lot of these players might have moved on. He's still got a grounding there, hasn't he? And that surely is going to help him, Reg.
No, he will. There's some interesting quotes as well. Just read out a few of them. It's really important to develop young players, and that would be one of my jobs. I want players who, whether they're 18 or 32, feel like Chelsea is their club. I'm not just talking about Mr. Chelsea, John Terry, but Petr Cech and Didier Drogba, who came here and felt the club. Nobody has an easy road in football. There are always questions asked of you. I haven't spoken to any of my old managers as it stands, and I don't plan to call any of them. We have to start with the intention to win. If I sat here and said, and I didn't say that, I don't think I should be here. So he was questioned a lot as to what is success for Chelsea this season. And he was quite careful. He didn't really want to answer the question, if truth be told, because it is a difficult question. What is success for Chelsea this year? In the end, when he was pushed, he did say playing Champions League football is something that should drive us forward. I'm not going to start talking about league positions. Ask me that at the end of the year. I played it for many years and I know there are standards. That's the baseline of being competitive. Of course, there are variables. We know about the transfer ban. We know Man United and Liverpool pulled away, but we should never stop trying. Sorry, Man City and Liverpool pulled away, but we should never stop trying. And it is difficult because I think, what are the expectations? I think, like he said there, they've finished top four this season. They've lost Hazard. Of course, Hudson-Odoi is out for a period of time. So top four still has to be the goal, but it is going to be more difficult than last season. He is going to have to blood a lot of these youngsters, which I'm quite excited about. And it really could go one or two ways. If two or three of them really hit the ground running, suddenly we'll see a team that are established top four and they'll have no problem. If they have a couple of these players that really struggled to find their feet at that level, I do worry a little bit for them.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that he said he's got a lot of phone numbers in his contact book, old managers, but he's not going to call any of them. What do you reckon that the conversation with Jose Mourinho would go like, Rich?
Jose? How are you?
Miserable.
Miserable. Yeah, sorry that I got the Chelsea job. I know you probably wanted to come back for a third time. Yeah, after a little bit of advice, Jose, is there anything that you would offer?
I think you just have to be the special one. You just have to be the special one and always make sure you create a poisonous atmosphere in the changing room.
Okay, and if like an interview is around a certain player, do I then talk about that player or do I bring it back to myself?
Only talk about them if it's negative and it would have a serious bad consequence on their confidence. Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Have you got any particular sound bites that I can use?
Oh, gosh. Respect! 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 Yeah, so that's Jose Mourinho there. Thank you, Jose. Thank you.
Do you know what? And I always think this, if you're going to go into management, surely you would want to call on certain people. Like, there's going to be so many people happy for Frank Lampard. I would expect him to, the likes of Jose, we joke about it, but I would expect him to give him a call and be like, look, you know, what do you suggest? I'm going into this. And surely Jose will want him to do well. Or does he want anyone to do well?
I don't know. I mean, no, trying to get into Jose Mourinho's head is like, I mean, I'm pretty sure psychologists are now currently in therapy after having trying to give that a go. He's an enigma. I don't know what he wants. But yeah, but it's a little bit like, you know, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's been calling Sir Alex Ferguson. And, you know, that didn't work out that well, did it? Do you reckon Fergie could still do a job?
I'm sure he could. The game's moved on quite a bit, though, hasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we've got so many different characters. In fact, one of the characters we're going to talk about shortly is Marko Arnautovic, who is, I don't know, I say character. He is a character, of course, not a particularly positive one right now.
No, exactly. So this is obviously the West Ham striker who last January it was desperately trying to force through a move to China, or at least his brother, who's also his agent, was. Well, it's reared its head again now, hasn't it? And apparently he's got offers on the table from Chinese teams. And the thing that made me laugh, though, was that he put a press release out last year saying that he wanted to move to China to win things. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
Well, West Ham, according to sources, are willing to accept what has been described as a terrible deal for Marko Arnautovic, who club sources say has burnt his bridges. The deal could see him leave West Ham for $22.5 million. It sounds like the deal could be done any day now, but I think, I guess with all players, you get to a certain point when you're like, enough's enough. And the problem from West Ham's point of view is that they're backed into a bit of a corner here because they don't want to keep the player. They're going to take whatever they can get. And so ultimately, they're going to have to accept whatever they can get.
Absolutely. Yes, well, they are. And it's just an annoying situation, I think, aren't they? That China must just be a bit of a thorn in the side to a lot of these Premier League teams now because, you know, at any point, their agent probably can just put a contract in front of you that goes, well, he has been offered 90 million quid by a team you've never heard of in the Chinese second division. And technically, he could take that. So unless you improve his terms, he could go.
Well, and it's not just Premier League. It's amazing some of the deals that are out there. I know of a player that went to Iran, which, you know, you think, well, why would you go and play football in Iran? But it doesn't really matter what level you're playing at here. If suddenly you're offered a contract that's five times the amount of money, which genuinely, a lot of these contracts that are available over that side of the world are four or five times what you'll be on here. So naturally, a lot of these players will kick up a fuss. They'll do whatever they need to do to get out. And they kind of think, do you know what, even if I go and do a year in China, 2 years in China, you could set yourself up for however many lifetimes. Not that Marko Arnautovic will be short of a pound or two, I'm sure, but still, the opportunity to go and do that, you do understand to an extent, but you just feel that Marko Arnautovic has been pushing for this for well over a year now.
Yeah, I think West Ham fans have probably run out of patience. I wouldn't mind it, but he's not actually world class. You know, he isn't. He's obviously got quite an inflated sense of self-worth. I mean, he's just kind of one up from Andy Carroll, isn't he?
Well, yeah.
He's the Marks and Spencers to Andy Carroll's Aldi.
Oh, that's cutting.
Is it?
What's the top? If you've got Marks and Spencers, who would be a Waitrose?
Waitrose is the top level. Waitrose, well, it's probably an Aguero, isn't it? Aguero's Waitrose.
Does Harrods have their own section, don't they?
Oh, Harrods does, yes. Well, Harrods would be Mbappe.
Ah, okay.
Yes, yes. Anyway, talking to people that go to Harrods quite regularly.
Okay.
Wimbledon.
Yes.
Right. So Rafael Nadal manages to beat Nick Kyrgios in what was a game full of drama, full of adrenaline, full of controversy as well, Rich. Nick Kyrgios did his underarm serve, which aced Rafa Nadal.
Did it brilliantly.
Much to the kind of derision of the Wimbledon co. It's just not tennis. It's a martyre. Have you got another pork pie, darling? It was a little bit much. But I like it. It's in the rules and it wins in points. And if Rafa Nadal as well, this is the thing that people don't seem to go on about. Rafa Nadal has got so many like ticks and twitches and rituals that he has to do before every single point. Why does everything have to always be Rafa's way? You know, he stood there at the baseline, way behind the baseline. He just got this weird thing. He picks his pants out of his bum crack. Have you seen that? It's horrible to watch. Don't shake his hand after the game. And then he just twitches his eyebrow three times, bounces the ball about 13 times. He touches his arm, touches his face loads, and then he's ready. In the meantime, Nick Kyrgios just been stood there with the ball like, are you all right, mate? Come on, I'm getting old here.
That was one of the things that really wound him up, wasn't it? Especially when Nick Kyrgios was serving and he's having to wait for Rafa to go through his routine.
Yeah, and then Rafa goes and takes an extended toilet break. The thing is, there's a time limit. There's a time limit on the amount of time. So it's 2 minutes, basically, that you're allowed between serves. Right? And Rafa pushes that right to the max. And Kyrgios is just there, like, the umpire was not doing anything about it. Now, I don't condone the way that Kyrgios goes about his business. He called the umpire a disgrace. He said, oh, I bet you feel powerful. Well, he does feel powerful because he is the umpire, isn't it? The clue's in the name. But yeah, and he did have a go at that, and he got a code violation for that as well, Kyrgios.
And Kyrgios, the way in which he decided to try and solve it is smash the ball at Rafa Nadal.
Yes, so there was that one point again. But again, I thought this was good play because basically Kyrgios had served. The ball was then pushed back out wide right to Kyrgios' right. And Rafa's come into the net. So the angles are closed, right? You're not really going to lob him from there. You're at full stretch. It's not going to work. It's a risky shot. So he weighs it up and he goes, well, I could just smack it at him and hit him and win the point, which he did. And it's like, well, that's fine. That's in the rules. That's okay. You know, we don't play in the fair play league with respect. And I think that Kyrgios has ignited something here in Wimbledon. I think it is time, right, that we started giving Nick Kyrgios a little bit more credit. Right, the guy is obviously a bit of a menace, but I look at that kid and I think he's got issues. Like he's got anger issues. He's got, you know, he's obviously very on the brink a lot of the time, and you know, that's something that we need to help him with and not you know, kind of chastise him for, really, in my opinion anyway. He's a precocious young talent. He could be the best in the world. And you know what, I couldn't give less of a toss about watching another Wimbledon final with Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal. You could pause it and you could just show me one from 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years ago. It's the same game, but they're actually just getting older and slower. I want Nick Kyrgios in there a lot more.
Yeah, he is certainly a very talented player. Love sports. What's today's subject, Patrick?
Right, OK, so look, the transfer market has been a little bit slow to get going, but a lot of potential swap deals are on the go. Now, This is something that where you really come into your own, Rich, right? You've been a footballer. You know what goes on behind the scenes. That's why we call this feature Behind Closed Doors. Now, I want to know what it's like, really, realistically, to be a part of a swap deal or to put a swap deal together. Just as some examples, Juventus apparently are willing to offer several players for Paul Pogba, including Alexandro, Paulo Dybala and Blaise Matuidi as well. So basically they've gone, you three, we would essentially value as being the same worth collectively as Paul Pogba. Similar thing going on with Inter Milan as well. They look like they're willing to offer quite a few players, including Icardi, in favour of getting Romelu Lukaku through the door, which sounds like absolute madness, by the way. I can't work out, sorry, I digress here, but can't work out, just somebody, am I like a little bit blind when it comes to Romelu Lukaku? Because does everyone else see something that I don't in this guy? He's got a first touch like a trampoline.
He's powerful.
Well, so what? So's an actual ox. Do you know what I mean? Just go, no, we've just got a Shire horse playing up front for Manchester United. It's good in the air.
Good in the air.
Oh, hold it up well, won't it?
Yeah, runs the channels.
Yeah. No, but anyway, so right, look, we digress there. But being part of a swap deal, right, what, is it insulting for a player? How do clubs really work out? If we want Paul Pogba, these three players are what he's worth, etc., etc.
So a good example would be, let's use Paul Pogba for an example, where they can't find a valuation that they agree on. So, for instance, the club would offer, Juventus would offer an amount of money. Man United are like, no, do you know what, you're X amount short. At that point, Man United might say, do you know what, let's just have a look at what they've got on offer, who they have, what sort of players. And then they might go back and say, well, look, I'll tell you, we value Dybala at 50 million. So if we can include him in the deal, then actually this could make sense. You give us X plus the player, and then that kind of, for us, then makes more sense. Because naturally, you always value your players at more than someone else will value them. This is all part of the negotiation. You know, ask Donald Trump, the art of the deal. But no, naturally, you're always going to be off in valuations. And it's quite hard to get a deal done because you gradually get closer and closer and closer. Sometimes the deal happens, sometimes it doesn't. It's often a last step. It's a last chance saloon where you know the deal isn't going to happen, where you might be able to be a little bit creative and do something. I mean, I've heard some fascinating ones from the lower leagues, for instance, where it's got to the point where the deal's about to be done and they're just a little bit off. And then, for instance, the team, the lower team, might say, I'll tell you what, we'll do the deal providing you guarantee as a pre-season friendly. Like, that's an example, because instantly they know they're going to have the gate receipts from a pretty big pre-season friendly that might just make that slight bit of difference in order to get a deal done. So you'd be amazed at how creative clubs can get.
What about how insulting it must be for a player? So Dybala is widely regarded as one of the brightest strikers in Europe at the moment. You know, fantastic player. And he is one of three players that is going to be used to make way for Paul Pogba. That surely must just make you feel awful.
I mean, look, if he gets a move to Man United, which might be a move that he would want, and of course the player would need to want to go.
Yeah, but I mean, he can go from playing with Cristiano Ronaldo to looking over his shoulder and seeing Ashley Young.
Oh, whoa, you know, he's like one of my mates.
Is he?
Yeah.
Good lad. Did you go to university with him in Staffordshire as well?
Wow. This has gone downhill very quickly.
Woo!
Incredibly
Morning,
quickly.
Rich.
Yeah, thank you. Hey, Ashley Young, my ex-Watford teammate, has done brilliantly in his career.
He has done fantastic, but he's not Cristiano Ronaldo, is he?
No, he's not. This is a fair point. Back to the subject.
Yes.
Look, do they feel... I don't know. I don't think you care as a player. Ultimately, you're going to have a valuation. So it might be that they, on paper... Oh, here's another one for you. This is actually very interesting, in my opinion, is that when swap deals come into play as well, they can be a bit creative with the figures, because ultimately, who's to say who's worth what? So let's say, for instance, and I've heard of this one before, let's say, for instance, that a player has a sell-on clause. Mm. So Dybala, for argument's sake, his previous club, if he gets sold from Juventus, then the previous club are going to receive 20%, let's say, of the transfer fee. Now, Juventus might be like, do you know what? We don't really want to pay that club. So we're going to value Dybala at $1 million. Like, but they could do, because then as part of this deal, Man United are valuing them at 30 million, but the club might say, actually, we're going to value them at 1 million. So this whole deal suddenly becomes a lot less, but then Juventus are clever, because now they're not having to pay, if they sold Dybala for 30 million, they might have to pay 6 million to this other club. But actually, because on paper, it's only 1 million, suddenly this previous club get screwed.
Yeah.
But from Juventus' point of view, then instantly they've kind of made an extra 6 million, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's all very clever and gets quite complicated.
You were telling me about something as well when we were off air that I wasn't aware of, actually, that On the subject of players' contracts, when a move looks like it's going to go through, sometimes now players have started asking for something that you'd not heard of before. What was it with regards to their family?
Yeah, there's different fees that now get added in. So agency fees are the obvious one, yeah. But obviously a lot now, because the agency world has become unregulated, a lot of families get involved as well. So for instance, it might be that the dad is part of the team surrounding a player. So they'll have an additional fee for the family now as well. And that's becoming a bit of a thing, which it never was. And it's only recently.
So you just go, what? Can you give my family a mil, please?
Well, yeah, I mean, the rumours, and people will have heard of this kind of stuff before, where clubs will buy the dad a house. One of the classic ones will be, for instance, suddenly the club employs the dad right. on a really high salary to do scouting.
Right.
So things like this. I mean,
the dad's there just in the woods tying knots. Going, yeah, no, this is how you light a fire without a lighter, boys.
Wrong type of scouting. But there are lots of examples. There are lots of examples of that. Or certainly lots of stories of that. But no, the world of agency has changed completely. And when it comes to swap deals, they are a little bit of a minefield, but at the same time, it can be very cleverly done.
Okay. Because do you think this is something that we're going to see more and more now? Because it is basically another way of not fiddling your finances, because you can't say that legally, but almost.
Yeah, I think certainly with the FFP being as it is now, a lot of clubs are realising they can't spend money. And it is, it's like, you know, we all use the auction sites. If there's something you've got that you don't want, but you know someone else does want it, and then it just so happens you've got something of theirs that you want, then of course it's a way in which at the moment with FFP being as it is, you can actually get around that to an extent by doing a swap deal that on paper makes sense for both parties. And it might be that both players are valued at 10 million, but if you can do it slightly differently so it makes sense and you're not then breaching the FFP rules, then yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Do you not think though, so let's just say Manchester United do go for this offer where they swap Paul Pogba for Matuidi, Sandro and Dybala from Juventus. Now, isn't that just going to create quite an odd dynamic at Manchester United? Because you basically got, you know, a spine, as it were, of Juventus's team, the offcuts, playing for United. Well, you know, you go and play them in the Champions League and it's like, well, we didn't want three of you. We didn't think you were as good as this one guy that we've got.
But it doesn't mean they're not as good. That I think that's the point, is that sometimes you'll have a fantastic player that just won't fit into a particular system. So it might be they go to Man United and suddenly they become world beaters. So it's not that they are a level below Juventus. I don't think that's fair to say. I think it's a case that it's obviously not the right fit and Juventus see a lot more value in Paul Pogba, whereas United might see more value in these three. The other part to it is, as well as that sounds like a simple deal to do, suddenly United would have three contracts to negotiate. Yeah. The actual wages are going to be a lot more than a one Paul Pogba, you would think.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just talking about players who are obviously world-class talents that didn't quite fit into a system, I must say I always thought about that with regards to Emil Heskey for England.
Yes.
You know, I mean, that guy, there's nothing that he couldn't do with the football apart from score. They did an interesting feature with him on Russia Today.
Okay.
So I don't know if you've been made aware of Emil Heskey's feature on Russia
no.
Today. So I don't think Emil Heskey knew he was on Russia Today.
Okay.
And what they did was they got a bloke dressed up as a cow to bend over and see if Emil Heskey could hit his backside with a banjo. It's true.
Exactly. Yeah,
there's a video of it. Oh, no. Emil Heskey does it. And it's like, Emil, what are you doing, mate? Don't do this. Oh
dear. That was Behind Closed Doors for today. This is Love Sport. Last year's Tour de France winner Geraint Thomas says he feels no pressure to defend the title despite a difficult build-up in which he crashed in last month's Tour de Suisse. Joining us now is cycling journalist Laura Winter. Morning, Laura.
Morning. Hi, how are you?
We're good, thank you. Hope you're well too. Yeah. How big a chance does Geraint Thomas have of defending his title?
I think he has a great chance. He obviously is coming in with a difficult preparation after that crash in the Tour de Suisse, which did see him off the bike for a short while, probably longer than he'd have liked, and it saw him miss some vital racing days at the Tour de Suisse as well. I think one of his greatest rivals actually technically could be his teammate, Egan Bernal, the young Colombian who could really spice things up in this tour. And they're going in as joint leaders. So that means the team will work for both of them. And then it will be up to them in sort of the highest parts of those mountain stages who has the legs to win the stage. So that could be a really interesting dynamic. But Geraint Thomas is going in with, I think, a great attitude as well of saying, I've won the tour once. If I'm a one-hit wonder, it was a great hit to have. you know, most people dream of riding the Tour de France, and I've won it. So he's going in there saying there's no pressure on me, in a sense. That could all be blasé and bluff. I think he will be feeling the pressure, and he will want to do well, and he will want to back up what he did last year. And he's certainly got the team around him to do it. But yeah, he has had a difficult preparation, a shift in focus after Chris Froome crashed out as well. But he's got the tools to do it.
Yeah, well, he absolutely does. And it's not been the dream start for Team Ineos, of course, taking over from Team Sky, owned by Britain's richest man, Jim Ratcliffe, who was actually born in a council house in Salford as well, which he's done rather well for himself since then. But he's taken over now, Team Ineos. And yeah, they would have been hoping, obviously, to just go full steam ahead. Chris Froome, as per, but he's kind of shattered pretty much every bone in his body. There is another story going on in cycling at the moment regarding Mark Cavendish, actually, which we are going to return to Team Ineos later, but I want to pick up on this. Mark Cavendish is heartbroken. He's going to be missing the Tour de France for the first time since 2007 after being left out by Team Dimension Data. I mean, there's no creativity spared, is there, with these team names in cycling? But is this a surprise? Is it a big blow for Mark?
I think the sort of the jury's out on whether it's a surprise or not. Some people are saying he was riding into the form peak in July that he needed to do for the Tour de France, and his training was very specifically engineered that he would peak on certain days at the Tour de France, and he was hitting those targets and he was on course. Others look back over the last 2 years and say, well, he's had two wins in 2 years. He's battled back from injury, he's battled back from Epstein-Barr virus, which I actually have as well, and it wipes you out completely. So I fully understand that one. I think it's a very sad decision. Whether it's the right decision or not, that's down to the numbers that the performance managers of these teams see. But I know that Dimension Data were completely split on whether to take Mark Cavendish, and it was actually Doug Ryder, the team principal, who said, no, he's not going to come. So that was a big decision from him. It is sad, though, because it's almost a sort of changing of the guard moment. It's a kind of, he last missed out. He made his debut in 2007. You know, that's years ago. He's been riding the Tour de France for years. What is the Tour de France about Mark Cavendish going for that green jersey? It's a real seminal moment, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Just talking of seminal moments, obviously we did touch on it before. The fact that Chris Froome is out. He broke a bit of his neck. He broke a bit of his hip, I believe, and his arm. And he had a terrible crash during a practice ride when actually we believe he was going to blow his nose. He took a hand off the handlebar and the wind took him, and he careered off into a wall at about 40 miles an hour. So obviously we wish him well. But just obviously the fact that Ineos are going with this joint pairing, this joint lead rider pairing with Geraint Thomas there and Egan Bernal. Is there anyone else that's going to take place in the Tour de France that you think could actually swoop in? Because it just feels like there's a little bit of an open door there this year.
Yeah, it's wide open this year. I think it's the most open it's been for a while. And that makes for quite an exciting race, actually. So for Movistar, you've got Quintana, who has been thereabouts at every Grand Tour, but so often falling short. And they're also bringing Mikel Landa as well. So that duo will be sort of spearheading the Movistar campaign, a Spanish team and a Spanish and Colombian rider there. You've also got another Brit, Adam Yates and Mitchelton Scott as well. So that'll be exciting to see what he can do, because they're all in for him. He's got his brother Simon racing as well, riding alongside him. And obviously Simon fell short at the Giro just gone, and indeed last year as well, but came so close last year and lost the pink jersey in the final few days with that incredible Chris Froome attack. So Adam Yates could be one, really, I think, to watch out for. And there seems to be quite a lot of confidence around Adam Yates' campaign for this Tour de France. The French are still hoping and praying for a French winner of their landmark race. Thibaut Pinot of FDJ and Romain Bardet of Ager Désert Mondial are both riders who could do it. Romain Bardet certainly perhaps not having the time trialing prowess that's needed for an overall Grand Tour winner. And also Australian as well, Richie Porte, for Trek Segafredo. He's another name to watch out for, but hasn't yet this season shown the kind of form, I think, you'd expect from a Grand Tour winner. But you never know. These guys so often, as I mentioned with Mark Cavendish, engineer their training so they peak over a 3-week period in July for the Tour de France.
Great stuff. Laura, thank you very much. That's Laura Winter there, cycling journalist, giving us the latest on the Tour de France. Now, a quarter of betting shops on UK high streets have been slated for closure, putting 12,000 jobs at risk, with William Hill, the latest bookmaker to schedule high street shop closures. Joining us now to discuss this, what this means for the gambling industry, is Adam Bradford. Morning, Adam.
Morning.
Yeah, 12,000 jobs at risk. Not good news for the gambling firm.
It's not good news for the gambling firms, but actually I would argue that they probably should have seen this coming. I mean, we're linking a lot of back to the change in stake on the fixed odds betting terminals, where you used to be able to bet £100 every 20 seconds, which has gone down since April of this year to £2. But the government made the announcement about that policy change 14 months ago. So I would say probably people like William Hill haven't acted quickly enough to try and move their revenue elsewhere or try and recover the losses.
Yeah, well, look, absolutely. And Adam, obviously you do a lot of work as an anti-gambling campaigner. I understand that your father had a 30-year secret gambling addiction, hid it from yourselves, remortgaged your home and stole £50,000 from where he works. Obviously did some time for that. And I understand your father has a total debt of about £500,000. And, you know, look, obviously we look at this and go, well, 12,000 jobs are at risk if William Hill closed. And, oh, OK, I won't be able to nip down the betting shop anymore and just fritter away a tenner. But the reality is that the way betting has been rammed down our throats in this country for so long, you know, I mean, you wouldn't wave a bottle of scotch in front of Paul Gascoigne's face 15 times a day, would you? But if you're a gambling addict and you're watching the Premier League, you're there with gamble now. You've got Ray Winston in front of you going, gamble, go on, gamble. Give us the money, gamble. I mean, realistically, isn't this a good thing that William Hill are closing?
I don't know whether I'd say it's a good thing that they're closing. I think it's really sad for the people who are losing their jobs. And I think any campaign, you know, including ours, which has been around fixed odds betting terminals and now online gambling, there's always going to be unintended outcomes of it. And I think when you regulate any industry, there's going to either be a suppression in it or it's going to go the other way.
I think we might have lost Adam. Oh, yeah, we have. OK, no worries. Well, look, it's interesting this, Rich, because actually, coming from it from your perspective, football has a big gambling problem, doesn't it? Professional footballers have a big gambling problem.
Yeah, look,
not
I think...
All, not all of them. I can hear the PFA on the phone right now.
No, they do. Of course they do. I think it's not just professional footballers, of course. It's people in general having an addictive personality. Naturally, if you've got a lot of free time and you have got disposable income, then it's something that creates that little bit of a buzz, that little shot of adrenaline. I believe we've got Adam back on the line. Adam, can you hear us now?
Yeah, how are you
there? Sorry. We go. No, that's a much better line. No, we're just talking about footballers actually and gambling, but it's not just footballers, is it? I guess, is it a personality type, do you think, that will often lead someone to becoming addicted to gambling?
I'm not sure. I know that there was some research from, I think, one of the universities that said when you're playing on particularly these machines or online gambling, it kind of sets off like a chemical reaction in your brain. And then that's very similar to taking cocaine. So it's like a hit. So as soon as you press the button and you're trying to find out whether you're going to win or lose, it's that kind of split second, I guess, impulse, which makes it really addictive for some people. But oddly enough, not everybody gets addicted to it. So maybe it is something to do with personality.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I just can't get over how easy it is for people to spend the amount of money they could spend. You mentioned then that, you know, you could bet, what was it, £100 every 2 seconds or something like that on one of these machines, was
every
it?
20.
Every 20
yeah, every
seconds. 20 I mean, seconds. The fact is as well that a lot of these gambling shops are often right near a cash point. They're often in some more deprived areas as well. Not always, but often. When you go down a street in a relatively low-income area, you usually see all these gambling shops. I can't help but feel like for quite a long time now, gambling firms have profited off the back of very vulnerable people.
Potentially, yeah. And of course, they'd never tell you that. But I think they've been very strategic business people. They've managed to piggyback off quite weak and old legislation. I mean, the Gambling Act is from 2005. So that doesn't even account for the rise in advertising and social media and, you know, the way that football and gambling seem to have become one. All of these things have happened in the past kind of decade or so when legislation has just kind of been sat in the corner and we've not really touched it. So they've exploited a hole in the market, and now I think it's time that social responsibility came in, because we've got 430,000 people who are addicted to gambling, another 2 million people who are at risk of becoming gambling addicts, and 55,000 kids, according to the Gambling Commission, who have a serious gambling problem, and they're underage. So I think, yeah, you know, maybe it is about time the industry scaled back a bit and looked at the way it's doing things.
Indeed. Adam, thank you very much for your contribution. That's Adam Bradford there giving us his thoughts on gambling. And, of course, William Hill closing down, is it 700-plus stores?
700 stores and 12,000 jobs put at risk. Now, look, I do feel for anyone who loses their job at any time, absolutely, I can't emphasise that enough. However, if you work in a gambling shop, I'm pretty sure you'll be able to find another similar level of work out there at the moment. And the damage that is being caused to a lot of people, I cannot believe it. I keep returning to this. You know, you would not go and dangle a bag of heroin in front of an addict's face. You would not go and you know, just start serving up drugs to people that you know have got an issue. You know, you wouldn't have gone up to George, but anyone, the type of bloke that goes up to Paul Gascoigne when you see him on a night out and goes, "Go on, Gazza, do you want a drink?" You are a gambling firm. You are what they do. When you see on Sky Sports now, Paul Merson, for goodness sake, is a presenter on Sky Sports. He has got a gambling problem. He's come out and said this. He's lost millions. And he has to sit there while adverts relentlessly tell him to bet on the number of ruddy corners there are in a football match. I honestly think it's absolutely shocking. And you know what? I'm not shedding a tear for William Hill closing. They could close them all as far as I'm concerned.
Love sports. Well, we've discussed a lot of sport this morning. We've had a bit of fun, but actually we want to talk about something a little bit more, in fact, a lot more serious right now. Kids are paying vets or sewing up their own knife wounds to avoid going to hospital for fear of the police being informed, according to campaigners. Joining us now to discuss this harrowing issue is sports personality, unsung hero winner, Marcellus Baz, founder of Nottingham School of Boxing and former gang member. Morning, Marcellus.
Hiya.
Hi there. You know people who have used vets and attempted to stitch their own wounds. Why do children feel so under pressure from the authority to go to these lengths?
It's straightforward, really. They know that if they go into an hospital or any kind of medical facility, it's going to be police or the authorities are going to be informed straight away. So in order to avoid that, they look at alternatives to try to stitch themselves up or go to vets, go to other medical professionals that they may know from the family or friends' families that they may be able to give money to just do something privately, or to access private medication like antibiotics, etc. Because, you know, it's a straightforward thing. You go to hospital, you're going to get police attention, you're going to get heat on you. They're going to ask you questions about, you know, what happened, how did this happen, and, you know, you could even get watched or whatever, and people would go against you if you sometimes went into hospital as well. So, you know, other elders or other gang members that are above you would kind of advise you, well, you better not go to hospital, you've got to get it dealt with outside, otherwise you're going to get heat on you and that will bring it heat onto us. So sometimes they even coerce to not going into hospitals.
Yeah, well, this is it. I mean, there's a story that's come out today. I mean, we hear a lot about county lines drug dealing, which is basically where people try to, you know, get their share of the drugs market in various places outside cities. So people from, you know, just using some examples here, London, Liverpool, Manchester, the bigger cities might try and branch out into more rural communities and set people up there, often youngsters. And they're using kids as young as 7 is the story that's come out today. Now, Marcellus, we've seen the fact that obviously these gangs are not afraid of essentially using and abusing a lot of young people. Is this just another way of doing that, where you could be a youngster sent out there to deal drugs on behalf of an older gang member, you are then the one that gets stabbed, and instead of being able to go to hospital, they make you go and pay a vet or just someone else to basically sort you out?
Yeah, I mean, this is a massive issue, which is we're seeing right across the board, right across the UK, where, you know, young people are being sold a dream, exploited. You know, they feel like their primary attachment is with these gang members, so they'll do absolutely anything for them. And then that's when these gang members are exploiting them and getting them to go to rural communities, transporting drugs, you know, selling drugs from houses, taking drugs to different sorts of people in different sort of areas. And it's basically, you know, once that young person realizes that they're in this dark place and they can't get out, they're basically under control of these gang members, and these guys can, you know, if they do get stabbed or they're on the front line or they get arrested, it's basically, you know, collateral damage to them. It's that it's not going to come back to the gang members. And this is why we at Switch Up and Nottingham School of Boxing take this very, very seriously. And we try to target young people from a very young age now to try to look at putting support in place with that young person and the parents to be able to pull them back from being in a vulnerable position where they can be groomed and exploited.
Marcellus, I believe that you've had some first-hand experience of what it's like to be stabbed and feel the full force of our knife crime epidemic.
Yeah. You know, unfortunate for me, in my previous life, I was attacked by, you know, three gang members at the time. And I had a machete come down towards my head. Luckily for me, I put my hands up and it went through both my hands, severed a lot of arteries. I lost a lot of blood and I actually died for a minute and was brought back by the hospital and the doctors that did a fantastic job. And, you know, that was a real low point for me. And I actually felt not just the physical damage, but the psychological damage and the damage that was done to my whole community. You know, from shopkeepers to friends to teachers to family members, so many people are traumatized and damaged by one single incident. So this is why, you know, what we do at Switch Up and Nottingham School of Boxing and other organizations across the country that are desperately trying to make a difference, it's imperative that, you know, we continue to keep doing that and keep campaigning and keep trying to get through to these young people and make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And can I ask, you obviously must have been, you were taken to hospital because they saved your life there. But then did the paramedics and did the medical staff start saying, right, well, look, we've got to call the police? Did the police get involved? What happened?
Absolutely. The police, you know, were informed straight away. I was under a lot of questioned by the police on numerous occasions. You know, you're just basically coming back from nearly dying, and you've got police officers questioning you. Then you've got people who are from your so-called gang family that you think they are actually making subtle threats that if you say something, you know, watch what happens to your family. You better not be, you know, talking to the police and stuff. So you're under immense pressure from both sides. And you're stuck in that in the middle, and you know it's a very, very dark place. And I can remember at that particular time, I was even suicidal. You know, I didn't know what to do and how to do it. But luckily for me, you know, I did make positive role models from when I started to box, and these positive role models helped me, you know, change my perception, helped me gain resilience, and to look at other means and methods of getting out of that situation, which, you know, I was lucky that I did, but many others don't.
Yeah, exactly. And I can't commend you, you know, highly enough for everything that you've done. And it's no surprise at all, of course, that you named Sports Personality Unsung Hero for what you do at the Nottingham School of Boxing and Switch Up as well, Marcellus. But I just want to get your take on, look, we hear a lot of these statistics at the minute that knife crime went up about 30% last year, gun crime as well. And so far in the capital alone, we've had 65 homicides. This is just in London this year, which is staggering. It's more than last year. It's a first world country, you know. And you think, goodness me, like it is a bit much. This, are you looking at this situation now, thinking it is getting worse? And apart from doing things like the wonderful work that you do with boxing and giving people positive role models, what can actually be done to stop this, or at least reduce the amount of gang crime and violent crime that we're seeing?
Yeah. I tell you what, I mean, there's a whole leap of variable factors that need to be looked at, societal issues that need to be looked at. I mean, you know, we've gone far more in depth now. What was happening is I have seen a massive spike in knife crime. It's very concerning because even in my time, being a gang member, it was nothing the way, you know, kids are just literally killing each other over a cigarette. You know, it's absolutely ridiculous at the moment. But, you know, what we have to do is you have to go into depth now. And what we do now at Nottingham School of Boxing and Switch Up is provide young people with a counselling service to be able to speak and talk about their previous traumas and try to put that behind them. We provide them with mentoring, like father figures, guidance, direction that we can give them through the mentoring service. We also provide a lot of young people education and employability, workshops and help them with trying to get their maths in English, because I'm seeing a massive amount of young people that are being excluded from school and not having the academic ability to be able to get on apprenticeships, and they can't get into jobs at full-time jobs at 16 years old, so they're in a lull, and they're the young people that tend to be getting pulled into criminality because they're trying to make means of money. And then the younger ones, it's important to provide them with positive activities to be able to give them a positive environment with positive role models to kind of look up to and replicate, rather than being on the streets and looking up to negative role models. So, you know, and with the government cuts, with more exclusions, with, parents, single parents, etc., that are struggling to make ends meet and actually work all the time, and the kids might lose their primary attachment with the parent and then get that with people on the streets who are negative. There's a whole leap of different factors that need addressing. So, where do you start? And we start from making sure that young people are in an environment where they can gain confidence through sports, using the power of sport, then bring in the counselling, then look at education. We go into schools and we do workshops around, you know, gang culture, knife crime awareness, educate young people of the consequences of what can happen if they do carry a knife, what can happen if they end up in that split second stabbing somebody in that little moment of anger, and what the consequences will happen with right across the community and how it can affect hundreds and hundreds of people.
Yeah. Marcellus, fantastic. It's a great thing you're doing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Marcellus Baz there.
I think importantly as well, Rich, sorry, this is an example of how sport can save lives.
Mm.
You know, Tyson Fury wasn't in a gang. But I do believe that he possibly would have been dead as a result of his, addiction to various things if it wouldn't have been for boxing, if boxing hadn't been there for him. And now, look, Marcellus Baz is here now doing this at Nottingham School of Boxing. I know that, for example, Anthony Joshua was involved in gangs, was involved in various things, and it was the Finchley Boxing Gym, the ABC gym in Finchley, that basically saved him. Now, he was heavyweight champion of the world until he got beaten by a fat Mexican bus driver, but there we are. And this is how sport can actually save lives, Rich.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.